The party's over. Now what? After the national convention, how do Texas Democrats plan to seize on the momentum? A closer look today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Coming up, our conversation with the head of the Texas Democratic Party on next steps in the run-up to November. Plus, a declaration of independence for women in U.S. politics. Also, a big arrest involving an effort to build a private border wall in South Texas. What's known and what isn't? The View from El Paso. A new batch of listener questions about COVID-19. A look back at the week in politics with the Texas Tribune and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 21st day of August. Well, you made it to another Friday, and we're so glad you're spending a bit of it with us. You know what they say, when even your opponents think you've done good, you probably knocked it out of the park. That appears to be the assessment of last night's closer for the Democratic Party's party, its national convention. Even the pundits at Fox News, who were quick to critique other speakers all week, appeared to lavish praise on Joe Biden's acceptance speech last night, relatively speaking, of course. Longtime Texas-based political consultant Karl Rove called Biden's speech, quote, an excellent end to the conversation, adding that the remarks were, in his words, very good. Former Bush administration spokesperson, now Fox host Dana Perino, shared that view, saying Biden, quote, just hit a home run in the bottom of the ninth, adding that it was probably the best speech of his life. The real test of Mr. Biden's speech, perhaps, or indeed his promise to end what he called a season of darkness, is whether it will resonate through to the top of November. Much may depend on how or whether Democrats can seize the momentum. Many pundits think Texas might be in play this year, which, if true, would mark an historic shift. To talk about next steps for Texas Democrats, we're joined now by the chair of the Texas Democratic Party, Gilberto Hinojosa. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
What was your assessment of how Joe Biden did last night in his acceptance speech?
I mean, I think he did great. I mean, I think it was a speech that came from the heart. It was something that helps you put in the proper perspective the contrast between him and Mr. Trump. I mean, it was a speech that I think told America what he was all about and what he stood for, and why he believed it was important that we unite together to save our democracy. And he did it in a forceful way, but also in a gentle way, in some respects, because I think that that's how people view him, as a gentleman, a decent man who deeply cares about our country, deeply cares about family, deeply has a deep faith in God, and someone who is going to take our government and use it for the benefit of all the people. I mean, that's the message that he was trying to portray, and I think he did it very effectively last night.
You spoke about how he spoke on issues that will have significance for all the people, a uniting message. What about here in Texas? Did he hit any notes that you think will have special resonance in the Lone Star State?
Well, yeah, he spoke a lot about this pandemic. I mean, Texas has been hit very hard by this pandemic. I'm from the Rio Grande Valley. I live in South Texas. I mean, we have been hit the hardest, not only in the state, but probably in the nation. I think I saw yesterday there was somewhere close to 900 people that had already died in Hidalgo County, about close to 500 people in Cameron County. I mean, these are numbers that, if you take it per capita, we're much higher than anywhere else in the country. And a large part of the reason is because, you know, there is a lack of access to healthcare in these communities. And so when he started talking about making sure that one of the most important things to Americans and to American families is access to healthcare, it resonates with our folks. It resonates with us because we see a lot of the folks that are dying today are people that couldn't seek health care because they didn't have access to health care. And so these are the themes that are important to Texans. I mean, you know, we see that we can't make it in this in this economy unless we have the proper education, and whether or not we invest resources in our education depends upon whether we get a proper education. And he made a commitment to Americans and to Texans that that is one of his number one priorities, and that every child that needs to go to college should have access to the resources to go to college. I mean, this is a dream that every Hispanic family in my community dreams about every day, and they wish for the best for their children. So these are the themes that I think people needed to hear. I mean, none of it was about hate. All of it was about love. I mean, we're a party that believes that love is how we should manage our government. Not that we don't fight when we need to fight for the values that are important to our community, but that more than anything else, as American families, we should unite together to resolve these serious issues affecting our community.
Chairman, if you think about the Texas Democratic Party platform and going forward, what steps now?
Well, the platform almost mirrors the national platform: access to healthcare, education, higher education, increased wages for working people, and climate, protecting our climate. I mean, all of this depends whether we achieve the things that we are in our platform depends upon whether we win this election. And so, you know, our focus is organizing the communities, getting people to go out and vote, registering people to vote, and making sure that we eliminate these barriers that are being placed in front of our voters by the Republican Party. So we think that if we can get past all of that, we will elect Democrats that will be able to ensure that that platform becomes a reality.
Gilberto Hinojosa is the chair of the Texas Democratic Party. Mr. Hinojosa, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Former White House advisor Steve Bannon has pleaded not guilty after he and three others were charged with wire fraud and money laundering in connection with a $25 million fundraising campaign to build a border wall in South Texas. They're accused of funneling some of the money for personal use. The group called the We Build the Wall Project has constructed some portions of border fencing in and around the Lone Star State. One portion of their barrier in the Rio Grande Valley, which has been slowed by lawsuits, is getting hit by realities on the ground, too, with major erosion just months after that section was completed. The group's also been building portions of a wall near El Paso, and that's where Angela Cocherga joins us from now. She is news director at our partner station, KTEP, in El Paso. Angela, welcome back to The Standard.
Hi, David.
Tell us a little bit more about Brian Kolfage. He is apparently the founder of this We Build the Wall organization. What's his profile been like there in El Paso?
Well, he had quite a high profile when the half-mile section of border wall went up here in El Paso, the first section of private wall that was touted as a great fundraising tool by the We Build the Wall people. He is a wounded warrior who founded this nonprofit organization. And when he unveiled the wall amid great fanfare, he promised that not a penny of the donations would go to anything but construction of this wall.
So, Angela, what's been the reaction from those who've heard about these indictments and who've been opposing this group's border wall? And we should mention, this has been constructed on private land, am I right?
Yes, private land, a private company that was happy to have the barrier. And, you know, in along this stretch of border of Texas, which is right on the state line, too, with New Mexico, people from the beginning, there were red flags about whether this wall had been built properly and with, you know, proper permitting. You know, the tiny little town of Sunland Park just across the state line seemed to not be aware of the proper permits had been done. They were not set up to have a massive construction project. And the International Boundary and Water Commission, U.S.-Mexico, that's based here in El Paso, had real questions about that they had not been talked to about, you know, the regulatory needs of putting together a giant structure. Almost overnight, it went up. So a lot of real red flags and concerns about people whether this wall would actually do what it was designed to do, stop migration. And right now, the migration at that point of the summer was actually asylum seekers who were turning themselves in, not sneaking in.
Well, tell us a little bit about how El Pasoans have been reacting to this. I mean, it must be something to see this a monument of sorts constructed there. Can you see it from the road? What does it look like?
Everyone can see it driving through I-10. It's right off I-10. You can see it, and you can see it at night, lit up, you know, as brightly lit, and going up a mountain. And again, it's a half mile, and you know, Border Patrol also had not been consulted. Later on, both the Border Patrol chief here in El Paso and the Chad Wolf with Homeland Security, the top person, interim person, touted and praised this wall. And of course, yesterday after the indictments, would not comment on what had happened there. And again, everyone who donated, you know, they were promised that not a penny would go towards anything but the construction of this barrier.
Anything similar to the erosion that's been happening with portions of this group's barriers in the Rio Grande Valley? Are you hearing anything about that?
I did check and have not been able to get a response back from Border Patrol. Our area here, the big issue in the high desert are very high winds. So that would be the issue here, not necessarily water, because it's not constructed along this riverbank like it is in the Rio Grande Valley. So I'm sure, you know, there will be some checks on that wall. I'm sure they're happening now because of what happened in the Rio Grande Valley. But at this point, the biggest concern is, you know, the amount of money spent, the fundraising issues, the permitting process, and whether, you know, that section of wall really did what it was. It did work as a wonderful backdrop for fundraising, but questions about it as a border enforcement tool with the changing face of immigration.
Angela Kucherga is news director for KTEP in El Paso. Angela, thanks again.
Thank you, David.
Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, has his eyes on a lot of news today and has been hearing from a lot of folks across Texas. What's the talk of Texas on this Friday, Wells?
That's certainly true, David. The reviews are in for Joe Biden's acceptance speech closing out the 2020 Democratic National Convention. Here's what some of our friends and listeners on Facebook are saying. Wendy Statzer Mueller says after the first few minutes where he seemed a bit of self-confidence, he then settled into it and his passion for what he believes in really shone through. I'm proud of what he hopes to do for our country. Eric Smith calls Joe Biden's speech the first understandable national plan we've heard in 4 years. He adds that he remembers when Biden was known for an off-the-cuff remark or gaffe. He showed nothing but raw competence and compassion in this speech, he says. Jonna Blackley says, as political speeches go, I found it dull and predictable, but that's not a criticism. I think there are Americans who will be attracted to the idea of a dull and predictable president in reaction to what they've had for the past 4 years. Meanwhile, Janice Hitchcock wasn't impressed. I understand the desperation of people that want to make him out to be a great leader, but that speech was a great-grandfather's plea to return to what was, she says. The other big story out there today, changes to the U.S. Postal Service making news, and the Postmaster General testifying before Congress today. We're watching that along with several other stories on social, David, so I'll be back with more later in the program.
Yeah, I've got my eyes on some of these weather maps. It appears that for the first time since the Great Depression, it's possible two tropical storm systems could be making landfall in the U.S. mainland, and we're looking at the Gulf of Mexico for both of them. Perhaps we'll have time a little later in the broadcast to get you caught up, but it's certainly something, one of many stories that we continue to track here at the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar back with more of your comments in about 35 minutes or so as the Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, a tax advantage savings program helping eligible Texans with disabilities save for the future. Learn more, including how the program works with certain public benefits, at texasable.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Several COVID vaccines are in human trials right now, but in San Antonio, researchers have discovered an animal that will allow scientists to broaden their search for vaccines and treatments for the disease that has shut down the world. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie tells us about it.
Someone opens a cage. Inside, a group of hungry mice. It's time for a snack. Mice have a key role in the search for a COVID vaccine, but Texas Biomedical Research Institute vaccine scientist Dr. Joanne Turner says these are not your ordinary mice.
So the mice that we're using to test for COVID are regular mice that have been genetically engineered to have the expression of a human receptor.
Genetically modified mice.
So normal lab mouse will not get sick from SARS-CoV-2. But as soon as you have a mouse that expresses the human ACE2 protein, they get incredibly sick. they have virus everywhere and a lot of really bad symptoms, which replicates really sick humans.
Turner is one of the leaders of the team that discovered these transgenic mice are a good animal model for testing treatments and vaccines for this coronavirus. Texas Biomed's Dr. Luis Martinez-Sobrido is another leader on the project.
Similar to other viruses, what it caused the people to die from infection is not the virus itself, is the, let's say, the immune reaction that you get to the viral infection from your own organism.
He explains that, like some humans, these mice experience cytokine storms in response to the COVID virus. That's an uncontrolled immune system response to a pathogen it doesn't recognize.
And that's what we found previously, for instance, with the 1918 influenza that killed 50 million people worldwide. It was not a different virus than any other influenza. It was just that the ability of causing this uncontrolled cytokine storm was what it makes the symptoms and the lethality of the virus so high.
Now that the Biomed team has figured out these mice get sick with COVID in much the same way humans do, they can get to work. But if there are several COVID vaccines already being tested in humans in the United States, why do you need an animal model at all?
Well, because the idea of going and testing vaccines directly in human without previous safety and efficacy studies in an animal model is completely unprecedented. It never happened before. It's the first time that happened. And quite understandable based on, you know, the pandemic of the virus.
Martinez-Sobrido says that means they had to be very careful with these first vaccine candidates.
I mean, the vaccines that they moved to human clinical trials, they have a very strong safety profile, and we knew that they are vaccines that they are not going to cause any side effect on humans, so they were pretty safe.
The same is true of potential COVID treatments they've been using in human trials, like remdesivir and dexamethasone. They've already been tested in humans and have a known safety profile. Now, though, thanks to our little mice friends, researchers could try a lot more options.
So having an animal model where we can test multiple vaccines or we can test multiple drugs, I think that is going to be a breakthrough.
A breakthrough that may eventually shine a light of hope all over the world. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
You can learn more about the race for a COVID vaccine in this week's episode of Texas Public Radio's Petri Dish podcast. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Marching band is an important part of the high school experience for many Texas students, but it's an activity that involves a lot of breathing and saliva, which can be transmitters of the coronavirus, as we've heard. Still, the show goes on at many schools as they get back in session. Sarah Self-Walbrick from Texas Tech Public Media takes us to band camp at Lubbock High School.
5, 6.
It's day 4 of summer marching band practice at Lubbock High School. Students in shorts and t-shirts take measured steps in a parking lot next to the school under an unforgiving noontime sun. 16-year-old saxophone player Tristan Wright isn't rehearsing today.
I just want to help be able to give people that one constant, you know, that one constant being band and having this community of people.
After 6 years of playing, Wright is a band leader and now mentors the younger members. 130 students are at band camp this year, a lot of them incoming freshmen.
Can we give a hand to the freshmen?
Between the online and in-person, it's going to look a bit different than, you know, everybody's in the band hall playing their instruments.
Wright says he'll take academic classes online in the fall, but will attend marching band in person. The school district is the only public one in the city, allowing students to do virtual classes, but participate in certain face-to-face activities.
I want instant sound on the downbeat. You do not have to hesitate. You know what the exercise is.
Block the band director, Melanie Settle, walks through the rows of students, spaced 6 feet apart, and gives directions through a headset microphone and a face mask.
Quality.
Everyone wears a mask. It's required by the Lubbock Independent School District. Brass and woodwind musicians pull their masks below their chins when it's time to play. After a surge of COVID cases in June, Lubbock has averaged a steady 90 new cases a day since July 1st. State guidelines allowed for summer marching band practices to start in August. Not every Texas district returned. but Lubbock ISD chose to. The district's fine arts director, Andrew Babcock, says based on research he's seen, marching band isn't much riskier than sitting in a math class. But he is following state guidelines, and they've come up with their own precautions. Practice is mostly outside and in smaller than usual groups.
We are doing mandated temperature checks for every student as they get out of their vehicle. So before they can even get onto the practice lot, we're doing all of the pre-symptom checks on every student.
Thank you. This is a new exercise. We've never done it before. I understand.
Settle says when the state gave the green light for school districts to have summer band practice, her students were excited.
They're just ready to be back and be with their friends and get back into their routines and feel normal again.
She says the students are taking the safety measures seriously so they can continue with the season, which will include the usual halftime performances at football games and band competitions.
So to have everybody back in the same space and remember that we're all in the same, we're all on the same journey, we're all doing the same thing, man, that culture is, it's priceless in person.
Band leader Tristan Wright says band makes school worthwhile for him. After graduation, he says he may pursue music education.
I've always just had, a drive to be here for band. The core classes, I'll go to those, but it's really band that keeps me interested and invested in school. It's what gets me up, and that's something that's just stayed with me.
Wright isn't the only student who feels that way about his extracurricular passion. Babcock, the district's fine arts director, says the majority of Lubbock ISD kids participate in the arts, and the social and emotional effects of participating in person balance the risk of gathering together during the pandemic.
This little window into a piece of normal that's done differently but still somewhat normal is filling a void that is really hard to quantify.
Can you take the quality of that sound and put it on the move? 16 to 5. Point to where you will be in 16 steps.
About a week after band camp started, at the beginning of this month, the school district confirmed one person with the Lubbock High band tested positive for COVID-19. The district superintendent and the principal wrote a statement to parents saying the exposure was low risk. The message from school leaders states, practice continues. In Lubbock, I'm Sarah Self-Walbrick.
Coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. We got the Texas Roundup and a whole lot more news coming at you on this Friday. Stick around for it as the Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Texas unemployment rate has fallen for the third month in a row. It dropped to 8% in July, down less than 1 percentage point from June. Meanwhile, Texas is applying for federal funds to give a $300 boost to people who've lost work during the coronavirus pandemic. KERA's Christopher Conley reports.
The additional $300 a week will go to every Texan who certifies that they lost their job, lost hours, or the ability to work because of the coronavirus, and who receives more than $100 per week in unemployment benefits. Texas Governor Greg Abbott followed at least 10 other states in applying for the funds, and Cisco Gomez from the Texas Workforce Commission says more than 1.3 million Texans will qualify.
People are going to begin seeing these payments as early as August 23rd. So just a few days away. So when they request payment, they'll see those options.
President Donald Trump signed an executive order authorizing the $300 boost to weekly unemployment benefits earlier this month. Texas is declining an option in the executive order to use state funds to add another $100 per week to unemployment checks. Trump's order came after a $600 per week unemployment boost authorized by Congress expired in July. House Democrats voted to extend the benefit, but Senate Republicans argue $600 is too generous. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
A North Texas Democrat says Congress is running out of time to fund the financially strapped U.S. Postal Service ahead of the November general election. Voting by mail is expected to surge amid the pandemic. Operational changes the Postmaster General enacted but then suspended this week raised concerns ballots won't arrive in time to be counted. Congressman Mark Veazey, who founded and co-chairs the Voting Rights Caucus, says delayed mail service also hurts the economy.
Because what postal workers are telling me is that not only do they not have confidence about people getting their mail, their ballots sent back on time, but they're also concerned about what this is going to do because Christmas. They're saying that there's no way they're going to be caught up by Christmas.
Congressman Vesey expects the Democrat-led U.S. House to approve relief funding for the USPS on Saturday. He also encourages eligible voters to apply for mail-in ballots now. And the McDonald Observatory in West Texas plans to welcome back visitors starting next Friday. The Mecca for stargazers in the Davis Mountains has been closed to the public since March due to COVID-19. Online reservations are required for programs, which will only be held outside and limited to 25% capacity. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the online UT High School, offering a full-time diploma program and a variety of individual courses, including for advanced placement. Learn more about options for the new school year at highschool.utexas.edu.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. As we've done most weeks during the pandemic, it's time once more to turn to your questions about COVID-19. We've been inviting listeners to send in questions about the coronavirus or what to do about it, and we've been getting some answers from Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
I'm glad to be back, David.
This question is from an anonymous listener who sent this to us through texasstandard.com/coronavirus. This person asks, Taiwan's population is over 23 million, and there have only been 7 COVID-related deaths there. Texas's population is over 29 million, but over 10,000 people have died from the virus here. What can we learn from Taiwan?
Taiwan did it all right. Of course, Taiwan sits on an island, which is considerably different than a lot of countries. They knew about MERS and previous SARS infections because they were affected by them, so they were very much prepared both to restrict travel into Taiwan and also to do some incredible efforts to minimize the transmission of COVID-19, including quarantining people pretty much whether they wanted to or not as soon as they were identified. Mm-hmm. That was something that the people of Taiwan, just like Korea and some other places, were willing to accept and trade that for some privacy and civil rights kinds of restrictions.
Dr. Campbell, here's a practical question for you. Just how safe is it to go to the dentist right now? And would you go to yours?
I have been to mine. I've had 2 dental hygiene appointments, and it was very, very impressive. I go to the dental school at UT in their practice. The dental hygienists are no longer using things like the water syringes, which can generate an aerosol, and people that have to have cavities or other kinds of procedures done will actually be tested ahead of time, and results come back as to whether they're COVID positive or not. So they're going to do everything they can to minimize the risk by common sense things, such as checking temperatures, for instance, on everyone that comes in.
Sounds like you're pretty comfortable with the process that dentists are putting in place.
I'm very comfortable with the academic setting that I went to, and I'm hoping that most dentists will follow that. It's part of the website, and so I'm hoping everybody else will emulate that good practice.
Well, now this question comes to us from listener Mellon West. Mellon asks, I'm trying to create a visual image of virus spread in the air. How does it move? How long does it stay airborne? Does it drift like cigarette smoke, or is it more like an aerosol?
That is a wonderful question, and there is a difference between the particles that are sneezed or coughed out, which are droplets, large droplets, and usually don't go beyond the 6-foot perimeter we've talked about. And then the other kinds of particles are micro drops, what would be called aerosols, similar to what you might get when you're using an asthma inhaler, for instance, and they can stay in the air much longer. The question, of course, is going to be how infectious is that kind of an aerosol? We're not certain. Experimentation hasn't been complete in that area. But there's no question that good ventilation, filtration of air, circulation of air, and even use of fans could make a big difference in terms of the aerosols, which do hang around longer and go farther than 6 feet.
You know, I'm wondering, Doctor, should any of that inform decision making when it comes to what spaces one might want to or not want to hang around in?
Outside is always better than inside, which would be a real good rule of thumb. There appears to be some benefit from what airlines are doing right now, which is circulation of air, very much like we do in hospitals when people are highly infectious. For the most part, the best thing to do is to continue to follow those social distancing rules, which is the 6 foot distance, the masking, and the hand washing, and then, of course, not spend prolonged periods of time indoors with people who do not do that.
Words to live by, especially right now. We've been talking with Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio. We've been having him join us regularly over the course of the coronavirus pandemic to answer your questions. Now, if you have something you'd like to ask, look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus, and you'll find a form there where you can submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for joining us again. We appreciate it.
I appreciate helping out.
Well, a major figure in Texas and national politics has contracted the coronavirus. Former Secretary of State and White House Chief of Staff James Baker tested positive, as did his wife, Susan. Baker served in the Reagan and Bush 41 cabinets. A spokesperson says the 90-year-old Houston native and his wife are feeling, quote, crummy, but probably will not need to be hospitalized. There's more of the Texas Standard coming up. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, offering annual preventative and screening appointments with safety protocols in place. Early detection is critical to better cancer outcomes. More at texasoncology.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. As the U.S. celebrates the 100th anniversary this week of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, establishing women's right to vote, we also celebrate the strides women have made in being elected to political office. But despite those strides, the highest office in the country, that of the President of the United States, remains to be held by a woman. Many political watchers thought 2016 might be the year that the glass ceiling would be broken, but Republican President Donald Trump's defeat of Democrat Hillary Clinton in the Electoral College made people like Jennifer Palmieri, who was the director of communications for Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign, question just how much progress women have made in the political sphere in this country in her lifetime. It's a question posed and elaborated upon in Palmieri's latest book, She Proclaims, Our Declaration of Independence from a Man's World. Palmieri, who also served as White House Director of Communications under the Obama administration from 2013 to 2015, joins us now. Ms. Palmieri, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me, David.
What was the inspiration for this new book, and what's the message you're trying to translate for other women who have careers in politics or who want to pursue careers in politics?
Well, I think the most important thing for people to know at the outset is I did not think it was going to be that hard to elect the first woman president. And I thought that we had elected the first Black president in America that was harder. And I just thought Hillary was the best person for the job. And once I started working for her, I ran into this the static that I had not encountered anywhere else in politics. And what I came to appreciate was just how important role models are in politics and leadership and what we think a leader looks like and sounds like. And it just opened up for me this new way of looking at how women how we have sort of internalized a notion that we need to act like men and modeled ourselves after them. And I think for a long while that worked. I mean, for decades that actually worked. Mm-hmm. And we made a lot of progress, but I think it's why we've stagnated and sort of hit a glass ceiling writ large, not just in politics. And what I want women to know now is you have nothing left to prove. You're not doing anything wrong. You've been trying to succeed in a world that wasn't built for you. And there are things you can change in your own mind that will put you on a different path.
Now, I want to ask you about something, because I think a lot of people have thought of this latest book that you've written as a kind of companion piece to another book that you wrote called Dear Madam President, where you take experiences from your time working on the Hillary Clinton campaign and create a sort of a blueprint for women who are trying to break through in roles that have been at least historically held by men?
Yeah, I wanted people to say, after I worked for Hillary, I said, I just came to appreciate how much, you know, as I said before, how much role models matter, how much it matters that all 45 presidents now have been men, so that whenever we hear a woman's voice, a woman politician, her voice doesn't sound quite right, right? When we see for all of human history, you know, if you look back for all of human history, a woman seeking power is an unusual thing. And when we see it, a woman with ambition, there's still something we're uneasy about with it. Again, not like people are trying to hold women back. Men and women both have these sort of biases in our heads, things we inherited. But I think this is why you hear about Hillary. For example, people would say, I don't know, there's something about her I just don't like. I don't know, there's something about her I don't trust. You hear about Elizabeth Warren, you hear about Kamala Harris. It's like, this is, and it's still sort of vexing for us, these like women that seek power. And with Dear Madam President, I want to like unearth that. And so like, this is what's going on, and here's what you should ignore. And this book is like, I want to say, okay, that's where we are. What do women do about it? And made it a Declaration of Independence to force specificity chapter by chapter. Here's one situation. Women don't think their voice has value. This is why, grounded in history, this is, you know, over the ages, this is why women have been sort of programmed to think our voices don't matter. Here's what you do about it now.
You mentioned Kamala Harris, and I didn't want to get too far from that, because there is this historic pick for Kamala Harris to run as Joe Biden's vice president on the Democratic ticket. Put that in context for us as you see it. What do you make of the Harris pick, and what does it do for Democrats at large and for Joe Biden?
I love politics, and I love the running mate pick, because it's like a switch is flipped and all of a sudden there's a ticket, and there is a running mate who life is forever changed, and who in this case takes a historic spot in American history. And that's who she is, right? One day she was a United States Senator, and the next day you realize, the hundreds of years this country has been around, from slavery at the founding to now, we've been on a trajectory for this woman with her background to become the first Black woman nominated for Vice President of the United States. And, you know, that's when you take a step back and realize, like, just how much change we are living through right now. I think it's a really mature pick for Biden. He talks about himself as a transition candidate, about where the country was going. This is a 77-year-old man who sees, you know, what the future is going to be, and wanted that as part of his ticket. I think it's something we're going to remember for a long time.
Knowing what you know about national politics and how this breaks down state by state, have to ask about how you might see this in context for the Lone Star State. Do you see her pick helping Joe Biden in Texas, especially in a year when a lot of people are thinking that Texas is actually in play for Democrats this go round?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of reasons why the Biden campaign in particular would think Texas want to play in Texas. First of all, don't discount the fact that the campaign manager managed Beto O'Rourke's campaign. She spent, right, Jen O'Malley Dillon joined Biden's campaign from El Paso. And so she is a big believer in Texas, extraordinarily knowledgeable about it. There's other staff that joined from Beto's campaign as well to Biden. That turnout that you all had on Super Tuesday was bonkers. I think it went to a 1.4 million increase, more voters, 2.1 million total. I mean, it was, so that shows you the potential for an enormous turnout on election day. Biden has an advantage with Hispanic voters. I saw that you all just had a poll the other day about this. But they're still undecided in that, you know, 13%, I think, were undecided. That could be the difference. Black women are the best voters and in politics, bar none, Democrats and Republicans both. You can count on Black women turn out more than any other demographic. And there are more Black voters in Texas than any other state in the nation. Kamala Harris could help with that as well. So there are all these factors, you know, a little, you know, there could be Hispanic voters, Black women in particular, the energy on the side of the people that, you know, Democrats and independents that don't support Trump, the Biden sort of affinity for that state. I think there's a lot of ways it's in play.
Jennifer Palmieri is the former communications director of Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign, and she was also White House communications director in the Obama administration. She has a new book out now called She Proclaims, Our Declaration of Independence from a Man's World. Ms. Palmieri, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us on The Standard.
Thank you, David. I really appreciate your time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
I'm David Fruchter, and I'm with the Typewriter Rodeo. We're a group of friends who take our vintage manual typewriters and write custom poems on the spot. Poem for a rising freshman. This was the year I was going to make it, leave my middle school behind, reinvent myself, or at least try to fake it, put my failures right out of my mind. Never had many friends. I was so far from cool. But this year I swore that would change. Now the waves of relief and disappointment are making me feel deranged. When you're young with anxiety and depression, what you yearn for, you still fear to get. And now that all that's been put off for a while, I'm wishing that I could forget every moment of cringe-worthy misstep, every dumb thing that I said. I just want to restart my whole life already. Why else would I get out of bed? And then, on my second ever Zoom class, I get a DM from a face I saw lurking down in the corner. Like me, she seemed out of place. She asks me if she is the only one who thinks this whole school sitch sucks. And suddenly, from nowhere, I'm wondering, will this year be so bad after all? I'm David Fruchter with the Typewriter Rodeo, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
That poem, of course, comes to us from our friends at Typewriter Rodeo. If you have an idea for a topic, let us hear from you. Send your request through social media or email texasstandard@kut.org. Now for a look at the week that was in Texas politics, and what a week it was. Joining us is Alex Samuels. She is political reporter for the Texas Tribune. Alex, welcome back to The Standard.
Always happy to be here.
This week, news of a legal battle between the Green Party and Texas Democrats. What exactly is going on?
Yeah, so state and national Democrats are essentially waging a legal offensive to kick Green Party candidates off the ballot in some of Texas's highest profile races as far. And so far, Democrats are seeing success. So on Wednesday, both a Travis County district judge and a state appeals court blocked the Green Party nominees for U.S. Senate and in the 21st congressional district from appearing on the ballot. Then the Austin-based Third Court of Appeals additionally forced the Green Party nominee for railroad commissioner off the ballot.
What is the rationale here that the Green Party didn't pay some kind of filing fee that is new to Texas political law?
Right. So the Democrats are largely targeting Green Party candidates because, as you said, they have not paid these filing fees, which is a new requirement for third parties under a law passed by the ledge last year. I think it's important to note that multiple lawsuits remain pending challenging this new law, and the Green Party of Texas has been transparent that most of its candidates are not paying the fees while they await a resolution to the litigation.
Understood. Well, lots of news about the Postal Service this week since we're talking about the election and possible delays. What should Texans know if they want to vote by mail? Where does that stand at this point? We've been hearing so much.
Yeah, so if for most people voting absentee, Texas counties must receive completed ballots by Election Day. If they're postmarked by 7 p.m. that day, they'll be counted if they come in the next day by 5 p.m. So the U.S. Postal Service recommends that Texans ask for mail-in ballots no later than 15 days out from that due date. Mm-hmm. But state law requires voters to request the ballots up until a week and a half before Election Day. So some may not receive their ballots until it's too late to mail them back in time.
Oh, boy. Okay, so we have some deadlines there. And we should note, we're going to put some of the details at our website, at texasstandard.org. If you can or want to vote in person, Alex, when does early voting actually start? How long does that go?
Yeah, the governor extended the early voting period for the November election by 6 days, of course, citing continued challenges posed by the pandemic. So early voting will now begin on October 13th instead of October 19th, and the end date remains October 30th.
And has there been any sort of resolution when it comes to possible slowdowns in the U.S. Postal Service itself? Because that's been there's been a lot of anxiety expressed around that.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of anxiety about, you know, the USPS not getting ballots out in time to people who qualify for vote by mail. But I think we're sort of in the wait and see period to see if there is anything happening on the federal or state level to make it so everyone gets their ballots in time.
Alex Samuels is political reporter for the Texas Tribune. Alex, have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Yeah, Wells Dunbar, social media editor, you were just talking about the post office and a lot of anxiety that Texans have about whether or not their votes are going to make it to, to be counted.
Who would have thought in 2020 that the hot button issue would be the Postal Service? But here we are. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy testifying before Congress today, and he denied any sort of complicity with the president trying to slow things down. He said, quote, "I've never spoken to the president about the Postal Service other than to congratulate him or congratulate himself when he accepted the position." Although NPR does report that, yes, he has used this summer to cut overtime and withdraw sorting machines and take other measures. On our Facebook page, Jose Javier is one of the folks watching the live stream of his testimony, and he's curious about his investment in private postal service. I think he's referring there to USPS competitors, which USA Today says he has somewhere between $30 and $75 million of assets and investments. And another, real interesting aspect of this story that started percolating yesterday, I'm seeing it everywhere today. Here was the headline in the San Antonio Express News: postal worker, San Antonio Post Office hid backlogged mail from congressmen. And this is referring to Representative Joaquin Castro, who toured a San Antonio post office on Wednesday. And he said he was obviously concerned about these reports of slowdowns, but when he arrived, he did not see any indication of a huge backlog. Well, it turns out that a postal union representative says that a huge backlog of mail was indeed hidden from the representative. Wow. The headline in the Texas Tribune today: San Antonio postal union leader describes mass delays, says Postal Service hid backlogged mail from the congressman. And we have heard some strange and somewhat disturbing stories about the impact of the mail delay. I believe as the Los Angeles Times was reporting this week about how the practice of mailing baby chicks in the mail to farmers and, you know, folks that are going to grow them at home has been a widespread practice for years. But due to the slowdown, there's been reports of like dead baby chicks sitting in post office for quite some time. So obviously a story that is really continuing to pick up steam as we head into election season.
Yes, and as we head into the weekend, once again, keep an eye on the weather. There are two storms that threaten the Gulf. And so, of course, keep up with all the latest 24/7 over at TexasStandard.org. I'm David Brown along with Wells Dunbar. Have a wonderful weekend.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.